Hello, fellow watch lovers, nerds, enthusiasts, or however you identify. You're listening to 40 and 20, the Watch Clicker podcast with your hosts, Andrew, and my good friend Everett. Here, we talk about watches, food, drinks, life, and other things we like. Everett, how are you? You're muted.
I'm muted. No, I'm well. I can't think of anything super interesting to report. Life as usual. Life continues to march on. I do have something to report.
Okay, I figured you would.
Because we spoilered last week.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right?
We did,
yeah. Or I spoiled, I should say.
Everett has shit his pants 7 consecutive days on accident.
Yeah, that's right. No, today, the day we record, is my wife and I's...
Today, we're recording today. I'm sorry, I messed that up.
No, it's fine. We celebrated last night.
Okay, that's, yeah, okay, that tracks.
Yes, so it's our 20...
2 whole minutes.
20th wedding anniversary. The 20th anniversary of our wedding, which happened 20 years ago.
Happy exactly. Anniversary.
Yeah, thanks. It's, it's sort of weird... to think like, holy shit, that's a really fucking, it's a really long time. Anyway, for that, we were supposed to go to Vietnam this summer. We were supposed to take a trip to Vietnam, my wife and I. My kids were supposed to go to China. And while they were in China, we were going to go to Vietnam and then meet them in Beijing and travel to Thailand from there. So we were going to go to Vietnam for 7 days. Meet them in Beijing, and then go to Thailand for, I think, like another 2 days, because that's where my sister-in-law lives. And the kids' China trip got canceled, and so we scrapped.
When did she move to Thailand?
It's been probably 3 years ago. Yeah, they've been over there for a while. So
they knew that, but I was like, oh yeah, that tracks, and then just like wiped it from my memory of.
Yeah, they were in China for 6 or 7 years, and then they're in Thailand. And so we were gonna, anyway, I've wanted to go to Vietnam for a long time, but Kim has always wanted to go to Ireland and Scotland, and I'm like, why do you want to go to Ireland and Scotland?
The beautiful weather.
I know why I want to go to Vietnam. Like, there are, like, things. This is what I want to see. This is what I want to do. I want to eat this food. And Kim is, like, much more general about her desire, right? I was like, well, why do you want... So I've teased her over the years. And then this last year, she was a little bit more like, I want to take a trip. And I was like, okay, well, the kids are going to China. So really, we should try to get to Asia and meet them there. She's like, no, that makes sense. So anyway, when the kids' China trip got scrapped... Vietnam got scrapped too because it was just like, well, this doesn't make sense anymore.
Yeah, you don't have the parallel usefulness.
Correct. Thing. Correct. And it wasn't necessarily that the Vietnam trip got scrapped entirely, but it was like, okay, this plan that we did have is now scrapped in lieu of a different, probably later trip. But I was this last, month or so trying to figure out, I need a really good gift. And so I bought her tickets to Ireland and Scotland. So end of August, we are going to...
And gift number 2 is she doesn't have to take him.
Yeah, she just gets to go by herself. So end of August, we'll be going, flying into Dublin and spending, I think, 4 days in Dublin. And then, 3 days in Dublin, 1 day in Galway, sort of Comara-ish. And then flying into Edinburgh and spending another 3-ish days in the Edinburgh area before we come back. And within Edinburgh, we're probably going to take some road trips and stuff too. So driving on the wrong side.
You could probably spend the entire 3 days without ever leaving like the heart of the city of Edinburgh.
Yeah, I don't know. Excuse me, I gave a wrong pipe there. I don't know what I don't know. I don't know anything. Never been to Europe, Scotland, Ireland, never done any of it.
You're going to have to spend, how rigid, So I've never done a like a tourism trip like this. Like I've gone to Mexico and Hawaii, but those are like kind of different experiences because it's like we're really just going. Well, I was really just going because Sam wanted to go, and Sam was going to just lay on the beach or by the pool, and I was seeking shade.
Yeah, yeah.
So how rigid are you? Like how itinerant? Is that the right word?
Itinerant? I don't know. That's interesting that you say that, but
itinerary,
I don't know.
Itinerary, like how
itinerant? Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
That feels like a right. That feels like a
like you a maybe just like stumbled proper, into something.
Proper conjugation of that.
Golly,
what's happening? Are you dead?
I did the wrong pipe thing. It's just like I'm having a little trouble recovering. I'm gonna be fine. I just need some time.
Okay. I can wax poetic for a few minutes.
Get those muscles that like, you know, once you trigger it, it's just like, it's hard to like resume.
Have you ever had a cramp like under your chin when you yawn?
No, I don't think I have.
I have. And it's like, you feel it start to cramp and you're like, oh my God, no, I think I'm going to die. And then it cramps and it's terrible. Highly recommend against. I Googled it one time and it said that happens when you overuse the yawning muscle.
Oh, interesting.
Because apparently there's like some weird muscle activation here when you yawn. So apparently I'm just really tired.
Yeah, you got to go to bed. It says just go to bed immediately.
Yeah, for days. But I'm wondering what, like, how rigid of a schedule are you going to build? Because you can't go to an environment like that without like really intentional high point hits.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's maybe wrong. You know, the only rigidity we have built in, well, there's three
flight.
That's right. Yeah. There are three or four points where like we've got to be in a certain place at a certain time. Right. So, you know, obviously getting into Dublin, we're at the Dublin airport when we're at the Dublin airport. And that's pretty set in stone because we don't get there till we get there. And then day four, we've got to make our way to Shannon.
To then fly to Edinburgh to correct. Get you when you get there.
And then day, you know, the morning of day eight, we've got to be again at the Edinburgh airport. So, but beyond that, you know, we do have an agenda that we kind of, that I built out, that I gave it to her all sort of in a package. And but it's really pretty loose, right? You know, we've got, you know, loose plans to make our way to Connemara Galway on that day four. But, you know, there's no, like, we're not going to have, like, any shows that we're going to when we get there. At least I don't think so. So it's like, yeah, let's do this thing at this time. And if we decide at that time to do something different, so be it.
It would be food driven for me.
Yeah. Well, no, I think probably, you know, for us too, you know, I want to try this restaurant or I want to go to this pub, but you know, we're
40. See this castle.
Yeah, sure. That's right. Like, I know at some point we want to go to Edinburgh Castle or, you know, we want to see this garden. But all of that stuff is kind of go when you want to, right? There's not like, you know, oh, you've got to be there Tuesday morning at 6:30. You know, we may have to, you know, figure out like, oh, you got to have a ticket at a certain time to do this tour or whatever, maybe. But I'm pretty sure all of that stuff we'll by and large, kind of do it on the fly.
I read this article not too long ago. It's been in the last year, of these two women from the United States who, their sisters, who had this lifelong dream of going to Scotland and seeing castles. And that was their whole itinerary. It was just like castle to castle to castle to castle. And they were at this castle and they were like, oh, just so you know, we close in an hour. And they're like, okay, yeah, no, that's fine. But when that castle says we close in an hour, it means in an hour, the employees leave and they lock the gate. No. And so these women are like exploring this castle and they get like, they're in like some parapet or whatever. And they're like, we should probably go. It's like a couple minutes after.
And they're just locked in the castle.
And they are locked in. this castle. And they're there for a few hours, and some like neighbor kid, like kid from the neighboring farm comes by and is like standing in the field. And they're like, help us, help us. And, and he looks at him and like, that's weird. And did the right thing and went home and told an adult who then alerted the authorities and then rescued these trapped women in this.
I mean, they probably would have been okay.
I mean, it's not like it has electricity.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, it's Ireland, right? It's always between
40 and 55 degrees.
That's exactly right. Yeah. It would have been fine. I don't actually know if it's in Ireland. No, I'll look forward to
it. It was either in Ireland or Scotland. It was a place where there's a bucket load of castles, right?
I look forward,
it's probably Scotland.
I look forward to the movie starring Reese Witherspoon. It's going to be.
It'll come out in 25 years.
I don't know why that was a good joke, but it felt funny when I said it. I was like, I know this is going to land.
It hit, yeah.
I don't really understand the joke. Like, if you asked me to explain it, I couldn't.
But it hit. Well played.
Yeah.
I'm still laughing.
It's the little things in life. It's the little things in life. No, but so that's how I'm doing. I gave her that gift. I made like a 1960s travel agency itinerary that I gave her, which I kind of like made it like from scratch. I sort of whole cloth. I found an old 1960s travel agency itinerary on eBay and sort of recreated that. I used Affinity Designer, and then I used a typewriter. My first experience using a typewriter, because...
Did you buy a typewriter for this, or
no,
you just have one?
No, you have one. My friend Becky, shout out Becky, has a...
She's not going to hear it.
And she might. She might. She actually listens to this stuff every once in a while. She has an old Lettera 32, I don't know how you pronounce it, that she got and sort of refurbished and sort of... It's cute and cool. You know, a couple things. Using a typewriter, Andrew, there's no, well, at least this typewriter.
Electronic or mechanical?
Mechanical. Okay. And I think it's common for compact typewriters in particular. It was common for compact typewriters not to have ones and not to have zeros. Well, I did not know that. So I'm looking at the num line.
How much are you saving?
I'm looking at the num line and I'm like, well, there's no one. There's no one. You know what? You just use a lowercase L. And the way they form that letter, that sort of quote-unquote courier print or whatever that we might use today, was made specifically to sort of create those ambiguities. So when you type it out, it just looks right. You just know what it is. Your brain knows what it is. And for the zero, it's just an uppercase O. Like, now, if you're using Times New Roman or something, there's a different shape between the zero and the uppercase O, right? The zero is going to be narrower.
Which is why O's don't exist on license plates.
Because is that right?
Yeah, it's the same thing.
I didn't know that.
O's aren't in license plates or VIN numbers.
It's always
a zero.
Okay, the more you know. So anyway, yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of a learning curve. And also, I was doing this on cardstock. You know, typewriters are meant to type on paper. And the way they've got rollers that sort of create tension in the paper and a curve so that when you
strike the key, when the key smacks,
it's only touching the section. But that requires that convex roll to be in the right place. Well, with cardstock, it resists that. So it was a learning experience, Andrew. That's all I will say. It was a learning experience. Fun. But anyway, I made this like 1960s style itinerary card, and I had them printed up, and I made four of them. And I thought, well, I can get this done in four tries. And I was on the very last one. And I was like, this is just going to have to be good enough because I'm not going to go print more. Well, I could have, but yeah, it was fun. And so she, you know, I put it in an envelope and she opens it up. She's like, what the fuck is this? You know, and shortly she figured out. I put like sort of in the letterhead, I guess is what it is, or like the brand information. I sort of put a bunch of like Easter eggs about our relationship. And anyway, it was a lot of fun to do. It was a fun project to do. And the best part of doing this fun project is at the end of it, I also get to go to Ireland and Scotland. So anyway, that was my not so thinly veiled secret from last week.
Well done.
It's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to
it. Make sure you watch the Somebody Feed Phil Edinburgh episode.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good idea. I like somebody feed Phil.
Because he hit some cool spots that are like a little bit off the beaten path.
But like
are,
you might not find them in your...
Yeah, and he tends to do that in a really special way because he uses locals to be like, where should we go? Like, yeah. I'm not hitting the Zagat Guide. I'm not going to Noma just because I'm in the Netherlands. Or not, where was it? Amsterdam? Was sure. that where Noma was?
I don't remember.
Copenhagen. It was in Copenhagen. But that's like I'm not going there just because it's there and because I'm here. I want to know like where should I go?
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, actually, his stuff is always really good like that. He always winds up hitting a little bit of everything. Yeah, so.
Almost as good and perhaps maybe even better than in a lot of ways Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives because guy well, hits yeah. some really cool spots that you yeah. would otherwise never know about. But he kind of bugs me.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I can't really tell why.
Yeah, no, that's right, Andrew. You know, I will say I have heard absolutely nothing negative about Edinburgh. We're going to be in Dublin for more time. We're going to be in Ireland for more time than Scotland because I think, well, I don't know why.
That's just how precisely. It worked out.
That's just how it worked out. But everybody I've told about this trip is like, oh my gosh, you're going to love Edinburgh, which I thought, gosh, that's so interesting.
Why Edinburgh instead of like Glasgow?
I don't know, Andrew.
I accept.
Yeah.
Good enough.
Yeah, it was just sort of like, okay, let's fucking throw some darts at the cork
Glasgow?
Board.
Glasgow? How do they say it?
You know, I, Andrew.
We don't say things right.
We,
that's right. We're not, we're perhaps famous only for our mispronunciations.
Luke, feel free to chime in. Yeah, I don't know. It was just sort of like, you got to pick some destinations and.
Fair enough.
And pick some destinations. So there is some travel efficiency that was built into. So.
Yeah, when you're only doing 8 days, you kind of have to. You have to cull some stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we could easily have gone for, you know, a month and, you know, really been exhaustive about what we're doing. But instead it was like, no, this is a probably, you know, with teenagers at home and, you know, short of taking them, which, you know, felt like not for this trip. But short of taking them, it was like, okay, 8 days is kind of like... The outside, the outer
that's
the, limit.
That's north limit of asking somebody to mind your kids.
That's right. Well, and we are asking, you know, my mom's going to come to the house and take care of the kids for they'll be in their last week of summer. And so there'll be low requirements for any like shuttling or whatever.
Yeah. Y'all bitches go to sleep. You need to rest up for the school year.
So, yeah. Anyway, that's my surprise. Andrew, here we are. 17 minutes in.
You talked so much about yourself.
I'm really sorry. Andrew, how are you?
Your vanity is just unparalleled. I'm fine, thank you.
Let's talk about watches. What do you got?
All right. Which is good because
that's crazy. Is that the longest lead-in we've ever had? Jesus, I'm sorry.
No, it probably isn't.
It's up there though.
We've gone off the rails.
I feel like it's like 7 or 8 minutes. I'm sorry, you guys. You know, if you hated that, I'm really sorry.
No, it's fun. Celebrate it with us. That's a cool thing. And this is the show about watches, food, drinks, life, and other things we like.
And that's my life.
And that's what Everett's doing right now. He's going to go life in Ireland and those United places. Kingdom.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to get some sort of electronic travel authorization. Do you know anything about that? To go to the UK, you now need to get...
I don't go places.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I don't go places. I'm going to try to go to Luxembourg this year. My friend just moved there. His wife is like some kind of genius and got offered not just a job, but also like sponsorship to go work there.
Cool.
And the amount of money that she was offered was like... the kind of offer you can't refuse. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, so they moved to Luxembourg and he's like, dude, come hang out.
Yeah.
I'm like, yes.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I'll come hang out. He's like, I'll fly you. I was like, fuck yeah, you will.
I'm coming.
Like, let me renew my passport. I'm 2 months out from being able to do it online. I'm so angry. Oh. I'm 2 months out. So I have to go through the whole.
Like 2 months too late.
Yeah. 2 months too late.
Oh, that sucks.
Otherwise I'd have a new passport on the way. The new Amida DigiTrend. OC Black, OS2 perhaps, because it is the OS2.
Did you call it OC?
Yeah, I like OC.
Okay.
Does it not look like OC?
I'm pretty sure it's OS2.
I like OC.
Fair enough.
OCE? Maybe there's an apostrophe missing. Okay, so we've talked about this Amida Digi trend when it came out 2 years ago in 2024. And this is a
huge fans.
Yes, because it perfectly encapsulates this weird 1970s feel of like what's 2025 going to look like. Mm-hmm, it's like straight out of the Jetsons. And we have this sapphire top on it that allows you to see these discs that are backwards because they have to hit a mirror so that you can review this watch horizontally on your wrist. And it's ridiculous and every bit of 1970s futurism. And I love this watch. So here's the big takeaways. A new full loom display that makes it look like 1970 is projecting into like 2050. This is, it took this Amida Digi trend and like really, really went for it. The first Digi trend I really liked. The size is, it's big because it's a square watch, and at 40 millimeters for a square horizontal view watch, it's 39.6 by 39. It's just, it's big, and it's going to wear big, and it's kind of meant to. It has the Soprod Newton P092 automatic movement, 5,150 Swiss francs on a strap.
I got P024.
P024? I'm reading P092.
Oh, so I think there is an automatic and let's see. I think they might be using two different movements.
Are there two movements?
Yeah, shit. I don't know. I've got P024, but whatever. Yeah. The Soprod Newton P024 with an in-house design jump hour module from Amida.
I'm reading a 92 automatic. So maybe there's two. No, in-house 92. Mm-hmm. There's perhaps a typo somewhere.
Yeah.
Somebody's wrong about something, because I also see P024. So there's a typo.
And an internally developed jump hour module that they sit on the Soprod.
Right. All it is the DigiTrend, but now a full loomed disc set underneath the sapphire top.
Mm-hmm. And
it's money. I love it. This is how to iterate on something futuristic, silly, novel, but not exactly novelty watch.
Yeah.
That really calls back to the 60s and 70s kind of pre-quartz crisis, like sort of on the cusp of it. I love this watch. If it wasn't like $5,500, I think I'd get one. I love this like $3,500 worth. I think that would be my threshold for my amount of love.
Yeah, I mean over $5,000, it's a big ask.
Yeah, but
we're going to talk about some other watches. I was looking at this, and I was like, you know, it's cool, man. Listen,
there's a bracelet option.
This Edgelord on Hodinkee TGH says an expensive gimmick. IMO, others, of course, would love it. All right, TGH.
You have an Oxford, problem.
No, this thing's rad. And you know, you mentioned that it's a big watch. I'm not sure I agree with that.
40 millimeter square is big.
I think on, compared to, a standard format watch, obviously those dimensions would be big.
Because it's also 15.6 thick, and it has to be able to be legible.
But this thing is not really like, this isn't really like, a regular format watch. So you don't have to, I don't think we have to draw those direct comparisons. Yeah, all the wrist shots I see, this feels really appropriately watched, sized. And maybe, having never had one of these on my wrist, I shouldn't be saying that, but it doesn't feel to me like, in the photos at least, it's absurdly large.
It's got so much loom.
It seems right. It seems right to me.
Mido? Mido?
We've never been able to determine.
Mido. I'm going to settle for at least the next 10 minutes on Mido.
I'm going to go with Mido just to make sure that we're being equitable.
Just to split the difference. Yeah. Mido has updated its OceanStar 200.
Oh, nuts.
And this is my favorite type of update. This is my favorite type of update. It is a similarly spec'd watch as prior versions with some improvements that I'll discuss in a moment. But they have taken a sort of, I'm going to say, stodgy watch and made it into something aesthetically really appealing, at least for me. Let's just be clear. That's a subjective point of view. But subjectively, I think that this is a tremendous improvement. So OceanStar 200, an old watch, not a new watch, but
a legacy watch, perhaps.
Yeah, that's right. A legacy watch. But often I think not something. If someone says, I need a dive watch.
This isn't in my top 10.
It never gets brought up. No one ever says, oh, you really ought to look at Mido. Or you know, no one in my
No one ever says that, because people often say, you should maybe consider Mido.
Yeah, you know, I think especially at the range this is coming in, there's a lot of players, right? You got a billion Seiko watches. SPB 143, obviously, is the direction I went. A little bit less expensive watch, by and large. But you've got tons of watches from Christopher Ward. You know, you're now starting to look at sort of some Longines stuff maybe as a possibility.
And you're also maybe doing a little bit of an upsell, and you're talking Doxa, you're talking Monta, you're talking lots.
This watch just falls in a really interesting place because, you know, it's at that, you know, what's the actual price?
$1,500.
Yeah. So we're falling in like kind of a tough area, and there's a lot of really cool watches.
It's a little bit of a void that is also super saturated.
That's a fair way to, that's an interesting way to say that, but I can't disagree.
Like $1,200 to $1,800. There's so much and also kind of nothing.
This watch for me has gone from something I probably would never recommend to all of a sudden something I'm like, hey, you know what? This is really interesting.
If you really want to bushwhack and go way off the beaten path, consider this.
This is a watch that kind of gave me like inexpensive Orient Diver vibes before. And all of a sudden now I'm like, oh, that is a really good looking.
You're not a fashion watch. You're not a economy watch. You're kind of just like there.
This is a good watch. Mm-hmm. This is a good watch. Not a small change either. This isn't sort of that like incremental change. This is a really full redesign. It's a full facelift. we've got you know. Like I said, specs are basically the same, but slightly smaller case, 41 millimeters across, slightly thinner at 11.65. I think the previous version was just over 12. Very nice 47 millimeter lug to lug, 200 meters of water resistance. Obviously, if you've been paying any attention, really, really, really nice flanks on the case. Well redesigned bezel, if you ask me. An aluminum insert, which is a choice, and I like it. I don't mind it.
I think it works with the color, the dial colors they've chosen.
Some aggressive crown guards. I would say we get like a little bit of like, this is kind of, for me, a little bit of Seiko vibe. Mm-hmm. In terms of the way the case sits now, like especially the top down, and maybe a little bit of like Tudor vibe from the side, which is all good. All of these things I'm saying are good in my mind. And then we've got like a really aggressive, the old Mido OceanStar had this really sort of like open abyss of a dial, which I always hate. And I think that always makes watches look cheaper. They've really created a more compact dial here with this sort of aggressively sloped rehot that brings...
That's colored different from the rest of the dial. It creates some depth.
It does. I think it's really just texture, but it does create a color difference, a color delta.
It could be texture only.
And then the markers are sort of more like compacted and they look bigger and just more tooly and more aggressive.
A little chunky.
Nice texture, although I generally don't like sand texture. The texture on the dial really works. And the handset. I'm like,
it's really fine grit. This is like 500 grit sandpaper. It's soft.
Yeah. This is all of a sudden just a much more appealing watch, if you ask me. We've got a handful of different colors. There is a blue on blue, black on black, white on black.
That one got me.
And then white on steel. And I agree with you that the white on black is attractive. The white on steel is the one that I was sort of surprised to really like.
Oh, interesting.
Or the white on silver.
I didn't dig that one.
It's got sort of yellow accents, and I think they did a really good job with those colors. Those colors really go really well together, and I thought it was fantastic. Caliber 80 in this.
I would have liked that one better if it was white on white.
Because I think that if yellow, the bezel was white,
yeah, I think that yellow contrast on that Arctic white bezel would have been a little bit more pronounced and fun.
Andrew, I don't know if white anodizing on aluminum is all that effective.
I don't know either. I mean, there's a reason they chose this color. I think because that was their two mismatches, right? You've got a really cool white and black, and they're like, oh, we can't do white and white. We shouldn't do another white and black. White and blue is kind of weird. Let's try white and silver.
Scientifically, true white anodized aluminum does not exist. Anodizing creates a transparent oxide layer, and white pigment molecules are too large to fit into the microscopic pores of the metal. Any product marketed as white anodized is actually aluminum finished with an opaque coating. So there you go. That's the difficulty.
Well, now the metallurgist episode has been ruined. So...
I think this thing's really great. The case back to me feels a little sort of micro brandy, but whatever.
It feels exactly what I expect from Ido.
That's right. The case back and the bracelet, they do have a fantastic sort of dive clasp on this thing. It looks a little big, but you know, such is life. And $1,400 US dollars.
There's something I'm surprised you haven't commented on.
Tell me.
The mail end link.
Oh, you know what, Andrew? This case is built. The case actually
is built to support it.
Curves.
It works
down really relatively sharply at the end, and that mail end link doesn't.
It contours at the same rate the case does.
It just doesn't do a bad thing. It doesn't do the bad mail end link thing. It's questionable, but for me, it gets a pass.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, just aesthetically, it doesn't draw my eye in the same way that a lot of these mail end links do. I think it's acceptable. In fact, in some of the pictures, some of the top downs, it's almost like, is that? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. It's not the offensive Hamilton.
I can offend you with a mail end link.
I bet you could. What's next?
The Grand Seiko Core Evolution 9 with some new bracelet adjustments, mm-hmm. some micro adjust mm-hmm. clasps, mm-hmm. some new colorways, and I think a deeply offensive mail end link.
Oh yeah. No, Grand Seiko is a
just one of the biggest offenders. So the Evolution 9 I think is one of my favorites.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I just, it doesn't have a power reserve indicator.
Wow. Which Evo 9 are you talking about? I mean,
it's not offensively thick for Grand Seiko, right? It's sub 12.
I feel like that. So before you move further, I'll just say, when you say it's one of your favorites, I pause just a second, because for me, the biggest criticism I've had, well, not the biggest. Sorry, I'll back up. One of my main criticisms with the Evolution 9 line is that it's so discordant. It's like, you just, this is just a thing you attach to watches
without any real, in my mind, rhyme or reason. Some of them have UFA movements, some of them don't. Some of them have good clasps, some of them don't. It's like, this just doesn't mean anything.
It's a weird experimental space for Grand Seiko. But we've got some new colors. So three birch colors.
More than new colors. It's like
with a brand new bracelet.
11 new SKUs.
And it may be. Yeah. It's a bucket load of stuff with a micro adjust clasp, an updated bracelet. I like all these colors. I couldn't care less about the storytelling of Grand Seiko's color decisions, but I like all these colors. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 spring drive and 1, 2, 3, 4 mechanical, 37 and 40 millimeter cases. Between 11.4, so the 37s come in at 11.4, the 40s at 11.7. Ever brilliant steel or high intensity titanium, 100 meters of water resistance, better taper on these bracelets. These are Grand Seiko, right? They're 10 grand for the steel, 11.4 for the titanium. But like Grand Seiko does, got almost all the way, and then this gnarly male end link actually stands the watch up when it's laying flat. It's bizarre.
Yeah, I mean,
I kind of came into watch world with like this high regard for Grand Seiko.
Same, dude.
And I was like, man, that's like, that's maybe peak watch making, peak watch design. I still do love spring drive, but I've come to hate Grand Seiko, I think.
Yeah, I it's not for me. You know, Grand Seiko, I'm the same, exactly the same, right? Where there was a period of time where I really held Grand Seiko in high regard. I thought, gosh, I got to get my hands on them. But now I have.
The only one I really ever liked that I've had in person was that
in New York
teapot one.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you know, look, so, I mean, there's some cool stuff here. First, Grand Seiko has made their micro adjust clasp standard on all of the Evolution 9, which has been one of the things, I mean, I commented on earlier. I was like, oh, you're releasing this new UFA watch, but you don't have you've got the old shitty clasp. I don't get it. And then all these mechanical watches are using the 9SA5 and the spring drive are using the new dope UFA spring drive. So great. That's great. All that's good. I think if you're into this and you're trying to drop $11,000 on a Grand Seiko, these are really cool watches. But for me, I mean, I'm not going to say they're not worth the money. I'm not going to be that guy. But like, I just can't imagine spending $12,000 perhaps on one of these watches. They just don't do any of the watch things that what we know is Grand Seiko has just amazing finishing, right? Like probably
perhaps the best in the industry.
Second to none for production watches, especially at this price range. I mean, if you want to start spending, you know, lots more money, I'm sure you can beat them. But at this price range, I think Grand Seiko's finishing is setting the mark, especially for, you know, sport watches. With that said, they're all thick. Mm-hmm. They're all chunky bitches. They've all got, you know, these end links that I fucking hate. And I'm gonna just say it. I don't like Grand Seiko's dials. They're not for me.
I do like the texture on these. I really, really do like their birch texture.
It's just not for me, man. It's not for me. Every time I see a snowflake in person, I'm like, I get it, but I also don't want it. I don't want it. And I know that's part of the appeal, right? I'm not saying you're wrong if you do like it. I'm just saying it's not for me, man. None of these. This is not a watch designed for me. This is a watch designed for a different watch person.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. I feel bad, but I'm with you, Andrew, where like there was a time when I was like, I got to get a Grand Seiko. I got to figure out a way. And now
I'm so glad I didn't.
Yep, that's right.
Because I know I wouldn't have loved it.
Like, I mean, I could figure out a way to spend $12,000 on a watch. For sure. If you said, hey, Everett, here's $12,000, go buy a watch.
I figured out I could make a dope decision. It's not going to be a Grand Seiko. It's just not going to be. There's no chance.
No.
There's no chance. I mean, give me 7,000. Same decision. It's not going to be a Grand Seiko. There's no world in which I spend that kind of money on a Grand Seiko.
Nope. Nope.
If I'm spending that money, it's not going to be Grand Seiko. Maine?
No, we're already on the topic. Just do that other one.
Oh, which other one?
The new Presage.
Oh, I didn't read anything about that, so you'll have to leave. Okay,
so there are four
new... The rice paper ones, or the silk?
The silk-inspired. There are four new silk-inspired 38-millimeter watches joining the Presage Classic Series. and when I first saw these, I was like, oh, interesting. Why is King Seiko getting moved into the Presage Series?
Why, I don't
because understand. These feel very King Seiko-y
with the bracelets.
Yeah, the bracelets. Yeah. This like Jubilee. These kind of washed out.
What a seven link.
Yeah. Yeah, these kind of washed out colors feel very vintagey.
Yeah.
And the Presage never really has felt like that for me.
Yeah, oftentimes it doesn't. Yeah,
it's felt kind of like a collision of heritage with modernization.
I agree.
And yeah, this feels pure heritage, 1960s and 70s washed out colors that are all really lovely. There's this like kind of really delicately limed green, white, rose gold crown or rose gold accented white, and then a gilted white. And they're all really lovely, and they all fit in the, I think, in the Presage line, but they stand out against the rest of what the Presage line is, I think.
Yeah, I mean, look.
And they're $1,000-ish, between $1,000 and $1,200.
So I'm gonna make one comment here.
Okay.
Just one comment. And in fact, I promise, no, that's not true. I'm gonna make more than one comment, but I'm just gonna make one comment. 38 millimeters by 12.9 thick.
Yes.
Sorry.
Wrist presence.
Sorry. I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm out. And Andrew
heard, and I don't disagree.
I don't know if you disagree with this, and please tell me if you do. But these look at least top down cheap to me. That end link looks cheap to me. These do not look to me on
they look like Seiko finishing, right? Seiko is not.
This looks good like a Seiko 5.
At tight tolerances.
This looks like a Seiko 5. I do not like these watches. The size, the diameter of these watches is appealing because we in this Presage Classic line, we have a 36 and a 40. I welcome a 38. I think that's a great decision. But it's 38 by 13, and they just look kind of junky. The only one I will say I don't feel that way about is the one with the rose gold.
Mm-hmm.
The rose gold PVD doesn't look, it's got like a fluting on the bezel or a coin edge on the bezel that gives it to me a little bit of sex.
A little bit, yep.
And so I will a comment. Of course, I've never touched these, and Seiko does a good job at really feeling quality, even if, you know, maybe that doesn't come across in pictures. Admitted. But yeah, no, this is nope.
It is it's a weird introduction, but nope. They do look cheap. They do look like Seiko 5s. I still like them, but not for $1,000.
I mean, you got 6 R51 movements, which is fantastic. But yeah, nope.
Yeah. I don't like it. It's a hard pass
for me. Hard pass. Maine, not a hard pass.
Now we can talk about it. Yeah.
Maine. Is that what we've decided on?
Yeah, I think we have.
Mine.
What a mine.
Mine. Right?
I don't think you're wrong.
Mine. Maine. Maine has started a boutique exclusive series. You know, Maine's had some weird, like, they like made watches with Nicolette. I don't know, whatever. The direction this company is taking for its marketing has puzzled me over time. Not in a bad way necessarily, just, but all of that aside, they make a handful of really, really compelling watches. And this Manhattan 37 Ultra Thin for me is one of, if not the most compelling watch they make. 37 millimeters, sort of classic rectangular case, taller than it is wide, which I think is a really, really fun. It's kind of like what, an octagonal rectangle? Is that
how many sides there are?
Yeah. Yeah, because it's eight, straight yeah. sides and a chamfered yeah. corner. And the Ultra Thin in particular, because it comes in at like 7.9 thick, I just think dimensionally this thing is great. It is sort of an integrated design, which is to say it's got like just a thin end link that connects to the mid case. Although
it's kind of like reverse integrated.
That's right. It is. It's like a reverse integrated. That's a great way to say it. And here they've taken their Ultra Thin, which has previously only been available, I think, with that sand texture. And when this watch came out, I was like, I love it, but I don't like the sand texture dial. I wish they'd do something else. This uses a dial from one of their other Manhattan watches, which is a Côte de Genève. And this has got like a gradient.
Fume. Fume if you're not being fancy.
Dude, this thing is fucking cool. It's this beautiful, like, indigo. Man, this is great. We don't have small seconds either, which is not my favorite part of that.
Yeah.
Of that Manhattan Ultra Thin. They've ditched the small seconds, giving us just hours and minutes, which I think is great for a watch like this. I love that. This is, in my mind, the dressiest of a dress sport watch. This is like, if you want a true dress sport watch that can like look good legitimately with a tuxedo and with, you know, your sailing gear or whatever rich people do,
boat shoes,
this is perfect. I really love it.
It's really good. I think deleting the small seconds is the right choice for this. This is a limited run, though.
Mm-hmm.
They're only...
Yep.
So it's not a limited quantity. It's just limited availability.
Limited time, yeah.
So 24-hour opening, 1,500 euros.
When is the opening, just for anybody who's listening at home? I know I had it, and I lost it.
Go to their website. It's available now. So, in fact, like you might be missing it by the time you hear.
Yeah. Get online. This does have a Le Jour Perret
D101
movement, which is a manual wind movement, and they
that integrated rubber on it looks good.
I disagree. They do have a see-through case back or a display case back. And I just don't think, movement.
We're outside of the 24 hours. You have to be notified.
Oh, shit. The movement here for me is the least compelling part of this watch, especially that display case back. It's a beautiful, the case back itself is beautiful, but the movement's not pretty. I mean, it's not ugly.
It's
not an attractive movement.
it's an unnecessary upgrade.
Yeah. Right. Whatever. It's not a bad looking movement. It's just not the sexiest fucking thing in the world. Which, you know, maybe just give us a simple, like, something you could engrave. I don't know. Anyway, I think this is great. I really think it's a great watch. Despite my complaints about the movement, bracelet looks great. Screw on case back. I really do think this is one of the coolest like dress watches out there right now, and it's at a terrific price, $1,500. Terrific.
Yeah, too bad you can't get it anymore.
I mean, you can still get it, just not this one, maybe.
Yeah,
you can still get the Ultra Thin though. What's next?
I have a weird one.
Okay.
The Titan Edge Ultra Slim Mechanical.
I saw this on your list. I have no clue what this is.
I didn't either. So I saw this and I started looking into Titan.
It's a little like Resonance.
Yeah.
Looking, yeah.
So Titan is this big conglomerate company who's been making watches since the early 2000s and kind of like hanging out in East Asian domestic markets and doing fashion brand watches. And I don't know what on earth could have prompted this, but they were like, you know what?
You know what?
Let's do something really cool.
Isn't it fun when watch companies do that?
Out of nowhere. I looked at their website. They're this huge conglomerate of businesses. In that, I mean, there's at least five different entities. Like, Matt, I think this is an India-based business. But, like, imagine Seiko in India. Or I might be wrong about India. Now I feel bad. But I think it's India.
Titan sounds like an Indian company. I don't know why.
And the names of all these, of all the people seem very Indian.
Okay. So it's either Indian or Pakistan.
Yeah, and I don't think Pakistan. So let me get in here. What we have is a watch that's been clearly inspired by brands like Resonance and Bulgari because they're looking to drop a rotating disc watch, dual rotating disc watch, that one disc displays the rotates the hours, one disc rotates the minutes, at 5.7 millimeters thick. And that is being powered by an in-house caliber that is 2.2 millimeters thick with a grade 2 titanium bracelet, a 30 meters of water resistance, titanium case. I'm fascinated by this watch. The bracelet, I think, is super ugly. It's like ungrouted tile for the bracelet itself, but the watch is fascinating. And here's where it gets exciting. When you see a sub 6 millimeter watch that's like cutting edge of in-house, or not in-house movement, but of in-house caliber movements, you're expecting a certain price tag. This is 3,000 francs.
That's crazy.
This Titan doesn't make sense.
Titan confirmed Indian company. They're actually a conglomerate with Titan, Fast Track, Raga, Xylus, Nebula.
Bunch of stuff.
Yeah. And confirmed Indian
company. Seiko of India.
Yeah.
And they were like, hey, let's do, you know, some cutting edge shit. And they did it. Because even with the ungrouted tile bracelet.
Don't love the bracelet.
Considered. I like everything about this. I like the idea of it. I like the research and develop that went into it. I'm here for it, and I'm really looking forward to future releases.
Yeah, like, let's do something
cool. Yeah, yeah, $3,000. You're getting dual rotating discs, like very reminiscent of Resonance. You're getting
in-house movement.
2.2 caliber. So it's
Edge 903.
So caliber. Somebody's making it, and they're tooling it.
Yeah, 2.2 millimeters thick.
Yeah.
And it's an attractive movement too. I mean, the bridge work here is fantastic.
I don't know enough about movements to be able to look at it and say where they're getting it from.
No, of course I don't either. Yeah.
This is
5.7 thick, dude.
That's, I saw that.
Grade 2 titanium at 5.7. That's like, fantastic.
And for 3,000 francs, right? So we're looking at 3,400 bucks.
3,500, like, yeah, probably. Maybe 4 grand. With VAT or whatever, I don't know.
This doesn't make sense. I had trouble. I read through this several times, and I'm looking at pictures of it, and I'm looking at numbers. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, it's a dual disc. I mean, this is a really cool watch.
Yeah, maybe this. And I saw another couple articles today that were talking about Indian watchmaking, and I didn't read them. And then after reading this, I was like, oh, maybe this is what happened. Maybe this company just decided to like go all in and start trying to compete on a global scale.
Well, you know, India is such a fascinating place, right? Because they have, you know, they've got sort of vertical integration in terms of their manufacturing capabilities, and they've got, you know, the smartest people on earth.
Yeah, I think that's an objective fact.
Yeah, right. I mean, they're it's, you know, you and you've got a really, really diverse economy, which is, I think, a nice way of saying you've got everything from very, very low income people to much higher. So you can
Like absolutely destitute to billionaires.
That's right. So there's room to have people doing, you know, jobs that you can't hire anybody for in America because we just can't afford it, right? That they've got the ability to, and they've got 8 gazillion people. I think that's the,
well, that's the actual number. Yeah, yeah. It's 8.1 gazillion.
And so it's a really interesting place. You know, I think it's, we've, you know, obviously we've spent some time talking about Indian watches on the show and the Indian watch industry, but I do think it's a really interesting place to look at moving forward, because they've got so much capability within their economic infrastructure.
Now it's just a matter of being able to project that authority globally.
Yeah, that's right, Andrew. Yeah.
I think we might be on the cusp of something cool.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about something earlier this week. I've picked up a few Japanese made tools in the last several months, and we've got like a sort of used tool place here in Eugene. It's only open on Saturdays. It's called Lance's Tools. It's open on Saturday, I think, from 9 to 2. It's the only, that's, Lance is a retired fellow.
That's the time that Lance is willing to use.
And it's like a shack, right? You walk in and it's probably 300 feet, maybe 12 feet deep by, you know, 25 feet wide. And he's just got, you know, tools, everything from sockets and ratchets to pliers and
a bucket of saws, I'm sure.
A bucket of saws. It's all like sort of garage sale stuff, but there's the quantity of the stuff he has. So if you wanted to pick up a metric socket set, as long as you didn't care about matching or whatever, you could go in there. You could probably find a full set of Craftsman USA sockets. You know, you'd have to pick and hunt, but you could probably do it because he's got literally thousands of sockets just sitting in bins. Anyway, I was there and I was noticing there are a lot of tools from the 60s, maybe 70s that are Japan stamped. And these are all sort of no-name brands, right? They're made in Japan. And you don't get the sense that these were competitive products when they were released. They were probably lower end products. Well, now Japan makes some of the finest tools on the face of the earth. And you know, of course, post-World War II, Japan had some,
they had a bunch of bulk steel to melt down.
They had some image problems, I would say, you know, globally, but you know, today, if you want to get some cool shit, like go for Kogan or, you know, Nepros or, you know, Japanese tools are competitive with the finest tools on earth. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, right? Like, here's a company that, you know, maybe in the 60s people, or here's a country that maybe in the 60s people would have kind of lifted their nose at a Japanese made socket versus, you know, made in USA Craftsman or whatever. Mm-hmm. And versus now, like if you get Japanese made Kokin sockets, you've probably got about the finest made socket on earth. And so when you say maybe we're on the cusp of something, I think you might be right. There might be space in the global market for India to say, hey, when we do it right, we do it really right. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be price competitive.
I think they're going to be more than price competitive. I think they're going to hold in that affordable zone. Yeah. And part of that is maybe like, I'm not super familiar with India's like labor laws or.
No, me either. Yeah. I know nothing. Yeah.
You know, ethical business practices. So that could be a factor in it. But I think they're going to be able to, at scale, be undercutting
Certainly, yeah. Well, and you know, I brought this up a couple weeks ago, but Taiwan has sort of done that, right? Mm-hmm. Where, like, if you're talking about, you know, any sort of tools to, you know, sockets and ratchets are probably the most famous example, but the wrenches too. Like, Taiwan is still, I think, in the United States at least, seen as maybe lesser than Taiwan or German made. But the reality is they're making stuff that is effectively just as good. Mm-hmm.
They don't have the brand recognition and legacy associated with their manufacturing practices, techniques.
But even people will say, oh, well, this is stamped made in China. I wish they were making it in Taiwan. Like, Taiwan is gaining a reputation for, if it's Taiwanese made, it's probably going to be good. Versus if it's marked made in China, way less certain.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's marked made in Taiwan, it's probably going to be good.
Because there's also a certain amount of risk associated with stamping something made.
And like ratcheting wrenches, if you want like a combination ratcheting wrench, you either buy Snap-on from the US at, you know, probably, you know, $30 a wrench. You buy Hazette from Germany, which is maybe a little bit less, or you get Taiwanese. That's it. And that's not an exaggeration. That's it. Those are the only players. If you want a ratcheting wrench, it's Taiwanese made. Unless you're going to pay $30 a wrench from Snap-on. That's it. You're getting fucking Taiwanese. And they're good. Those are they make the best ratcheting wrenches on earth because they're the only ones making them. You can't get them made in Germany. You can't get them made in Japan. Pretty hard to get them made in the US. It's Taiwanese. They're the only ones making those tools. So maybe India's headed there. Maybe they can find some places where they can be the only ones.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be cool. It'd be cool to see that.
It'd be an interesting explosion onto the global market from a region that doesn't have manufacturing prowess.
Well, I don't think that's fair.
Not in this space, right? 5 years ago, Bangalore came out.
Increasingly so they do, but yeah.
Bangalore right. Watch Company comes out 7 years ago, maybe, sure. Maybe 10. And people are like, an Indian watch
brand? Well, and they came out and they specifically came out in the enthusiast market that we swim in, right? Which mm-hmm. I would say even today, you know, we're looking at this Titan watch. We're like, who's Titan? Bangalore was crazy because it was like, they were just like, look, we're selling you watches.
Like, and they're not. And they're not bullshit.
And they're awesome.
Yes. And it's not to say that Bangalore paved the way for them, but it is to say that it was the first time I think that the majority of the watch enthusiast community was like, they make watches in India?
Yeah.
In fact, they do.
They do.
This one's really cool.
It's cool. Yeah. Sorry if I'm maybe a little babbly tonight.
Sorry we went on like a weird geopolitical rant.
Yeah, mate, I guess that was technically geopolitical. It doesn't feel political. It feels more excited than anything.
Yeah, I mean, there was no charge to it. We're excited about the burgeoning watch industry of India. And I'm excited to see what other companies, maybe not necessarily like Titan, but what other watch industry stuff comes out of this place in the world that is not known for their watches,
yeah,
that is not known for their fine manufacturing processes like Germany or Switzerland or Japan, but isn't coming to fuck around.
Yeah. You know, I've got a couple other things I could watch at. Watch at?
My goodness gracious.
I've had at least one beer.
I've had most of one.
Most of one, yeah.
Yeah, look at you go.
I mean,
I'm okay saving. I you know what? I will even. I'll do you this favor,
ooh,
ladies and gentlemen. I won't close the links that we didn't talk about tonight.
Is this episode 399, Andrew?
You know, I don't know.
Oh, interesting.
And I don't know because sometimes I pull up an old show note template and I just add one number to it.
So this is episode 399, which means that next week is episode 400.
And we have a special surprise. We are going to
gift. No, we don't.
I have a special gift that I'm going to offer, and I haven't really I haven't talked to you about it.
Oh,
or Will.
Okay.
But I'm gonna offer a special treat next week.
I can't. That now my interest is piqued.
It'll be interesting to you.
That's fun. Do I qualify for this giveaway?
Well, you're part of it.
Oh, I am the giveaway.
Yeah, you're the gift.
Okay. No one's gonna sign up for
you
this.
Get to fly Everett out to your house, and he is going to spend the weekend with you.
I'll bring my multimeter.
And he is a burden.
I've recently purchased a multimeter, and I've been just using it on things. I've been trying to find things to fix with it, and I have done so successfully.
So when you came over with your multimeter, I think I should tell you that I already did all that stuff with mine.
Well,
we came to the same conclusion relatively independently, and the tech,
I'm not sure. I think if you had given me like a little bit more, I didn't have quite enough time. I think I might have been able to.
No, the tech came to the same conclusion that we did, and then was like, oh no, the board's bad. So my HVAC unit failed.
Well, the one thing I wanted to do was check continuity between the board. And anyway, we're getting sidetracked once again.
Either way, I reached a conclusion. Everett was like, let me come over. And he reached this relatively same conclusion that I reached. Tech came over, reached the same conclusion, and then was like, let me just check one more thing. And then in checking the conclusion that we had all unanimously reached, found another, like a hidden thing that was in the, like, was the source of our thing and where we had concluded the issue was.
In fact, the idea that I wanted to try that you told me no, I couldn't try, would have told us that the thing you thought wasn't the thing. Agreed?
Mm-mm.
If I wanted to buy, yes. We'll talk about it later.
We're sidetracked. Oh, maybe perhaps. No. It wouldn't have deleted it because the delete would have still had to pass through that safety meter.
And it wouldn't have turned on?
Yeah, because there was a break in the wiring in a place that we couldn't access.
We'll talk about it later. Okay. Well, great. Other things. What you got?
I got a book this last week. We have been recently introduced to next day Amazon delivery. We have a near enough distribution center that we get the Amazon van doing next day delivery.
I either get next day or like 6 days.
Yes. Most of the stuff I buy is next day. And they're like, if you add more in the next hour, it's all coming tomorrow. I'm like, well, shit, I need to buy more things. So I recently got a book. I've been down a deep, deep, deep rabbit hole of East Carolina whole hog barbecue. The bottom has not yet been reached, and I'm still digging. Perhaps the most famous, currently the most famous East Carolina whole hog barbecue person and restaurant is a place called Sam Jones. They have a couple restaurants in North Carolina. And it's run by a fella named Sam Jones who grew up in a family that owned a barbecue restaurant called the Starlight Inn. Who had somehow no ownership stake in his dad and uncle's restaurant and was like, you know what? I'm going to strike out on my own. So this guy who grew up doing traditional, like five generations of this really simple style of whole hog barbecue, opens his own restaurant and gets a James Beard Award. Just nails it. And he and a fella named Daniel Vaughn, and for those of you familiar with the barbecue world, Daniel Vaughn is the editor-in-chief, or not the editor-in-chief, he's the barbecue editor for the Texas Monthly, because it's Texas, so obviously I'd have to have a barbecue editor.
Of course.
He's written a couple books. He's been featured in a ton of TV shows. Like, if you give a shit about barbecue, you know this name. Sam Jones wrote a book with Daniel Vaughn that's called Whole Hog Barbecue. And it's this really beautiful, semi-autobiographical, but mostly cookbook of the way they do it. Because there's no secret. That's how like beautifully simple this thing is that he does, that this extremely successful James Beard award-winning methodology. And he's like, look, this is how you can do this shit in your backyard.
Apple, whole, Kohl's.
Yeah, basically, save the apple.
Well, I'm going to use an apple.
And that's his whole thing. Is like,
I don't think you have to.
It creates a nice presentation, because then, especially with boar, because then you get the tusks, like the mouth opened up.
I think you need the apple.
But it's...
I know nothing.
I opened this book and I read it in, an hour, and I closed it and I opened it again and I started again, because the stories he tells about growing up in this world and this, or growing up in this barbecue world and in this family restaurant and this, he's got stories about rediscovering this 5-generation-old in-ground pit that was where it all began for his family. It's just this really like beautiful story about this rebellious son who then kind of reconnects with his roots and is doing a thing that his family's been doing for generations and doing it in a way that nobody else is doing it. It was a really delightful read.
It sounds terrific.
So it's called Whole Hog Barbecue. It's well written. It's got a couple dozen. It's got basically the Sam Jones barbecue recipe book in it, ranging from whole hog to turkey to chicken to ribs and sides and desserts, and with the like, there are entire sections dedicated to, all right, so you want to do one of these in your backyard. Here's your timeline. This is what you need to do at this time of day, the day before. And this is what you need to do at this time of day. And this is what, like to the hour timelines for, oh, you want to have one at 7 p.m.? Here you go. You want to have one at noon? You're going to have to adjust a little bit, but here you go. And here's how we do it at the restaurant. So if you want to build in a little buffer, it's fine. Because so much of it is just like this art and science is there, but so much more is the art and the knowledge. And I love it, because this rabbit hole began like 4 months ago. My friend was at Sam Jones and because they offer tours of their smokehouse. So he's like in their smokehouse looking at these whole hogs as they're working. He sent me pictures and I was like, well, I now have a purpose in life. I need to roast a whole hog over fire, and I need to stay up for an entire day just tending fire. It's a really lovely book. Even if you have no intention of doing whole hog, there's a bunch of other things in there. But also, there's something really romantic about doing a whole hog over coals of like from a burn barrel, where you just tend this fire for, you know, the better part of a day, and then flip it over and do a pig pick and just share it.
Sounds awesome.
It's lovely, and it's not the bottom of the rabbit hole. The next step is I'm going to do this.
We actually need to dig a hole.
No hole. 82 cinder blocks.
Oh, well, that's a lot of cinder blocks.
It's $300 of cinder blocks.
Okay. Andrew, I got another thing.
Do me.
So this was a surprise to me. This was a surprise to me. I was looking for a movie last weekend to watch with the family and came across a tile for a movie called Dust Bunny. And
I love that guy.
The tile was just intriguing enough to catch me. And then I looked at the Rotten Tomatoes. The numbers were good. And I was like, fuck it. This looks like, you know, it was rated R, but it was just rated R for violence, which with a bunch of teenagers, it's like, that's going to be fine. Like, I don't have to worry about, you know, that like terrible sex scene or whatever. Right. So I was like, oh, okay, let's do it. It's got Mads Mikkelsen in it, who's just fantastic.
He's just never done anything bad.
It's got Sophie Sloan, who I didn't know who that was. She's a child. She's fantastic also. She sort of gives vibes to me of a young Drew Barrymore.
Her name sounds familiar.
It's got David Dastmalchian, I think is how you say his name, who is someone who you will certainly recognize.
Yes.
But who maybe you might not know, and he's terrific. Anyway, what this movie is a hitman for hire assists a young child in ridding herself of the monster under her bed. If you are not intrigued, trust me, you are not alone. With that said, it is delightful. The director's name is Brian Fuller. And if you don't recognize that name, please rest assured, you do not need to look him up because you will see nothing. He has done nothing. He did a 2002 Carrie adaptation for television that was panned heavily. He is not a well-known director. He obviously convinced someone that he was worth taking a shot on, and he nailed it. So this movie is so fucking weird, Andrew. It sort of like gives anime vibes. There's like a bit of a like Japanese or maybe Korean feel.
Just the tile looks like that.
The costumes feel very Japanese. At some points, you're like in Chinatown, so you get like sort of like. Anyway, it aesthetically, it is gorgeous. Plot wise, it is compelling and silly and also amazing. And it's not a tearjerker. It's not gonna like you're not. There's no moment in the movie where you're like, oh, like where it catches you. But it's satisfying all the way through. It's similar in that regard to me, at least, as John Wick.
Just like entertaining.
The original John Wick.
You don't need to look at your phone even once. You're just along for the ride.
The five of us watched it together, and everybody, my wife included, we got to the end, and we're like, that was pretty fucking good. That was pretty good. And you get to the end.
If Kim likes a movie, that's the real stamp of approval.
Sure. If we both like it. Because she gets bored
super easy, and yeah, it's like,
That's right. Anyway, it was just terrific. Sigourney Weaver is as good in it as anything I've seen Sigourney Weaver in the last 30 years. She's terrific. And she's not the annoying Sigourney Weaver from Avatar. She is, in fact, just good Sigourney Weaver. It's great.
Ridley from Alien good?
Different, but yes, she's just good. It's like, gosh, you are a great actress.
She's never really fallen off.
No. Well, and she still looks gorgeous. She's got to be 70, and
she's got to be older than
that. To the extent she's doing plastic surgery, she's doing a really good job. She's got the best in the business. And clearly, there must be some of that, or maybe not. Maybe she's just got great genes.
She's 76.
That's fantastic. She's really good in it. Mads Mikkelsen is perfect. He is perfect all the way through.
Doesn't she like famously not get work done?
Andrew, I couldn't tell you. I don't even have the first. Absolutely no clue.
She doesn't get work done. That's a thing. Or she's just a magnificent liar.
She's killing it. She's killing it. Because I was like, God damn, Sigourney.
No Botox, no plastic surgery.
I'd hit it.
Wouldn't say no.
I mean, I wouldn't because I'm married, Kim. I would not.
When you shouldn't hit an old woman.
Come on. Old women need love too. Come on.
I didn't say love. Don't hit her. She's 76, Everett.
All right, we're firmly off the rails.
We've never made it back. I
don't think we were ever. We've been on tonight.
We've been on two wheels.
Andrew, what else do you want to say?
Nothing.
Thank you, folks, for joining us for this episode of 40 and 20 of the Watch Cooker Podcast. I messed that up a little bit. It's fine. I still just had one beer. Most of one beer. Why don't you check out our website, watchclicker.com, or you can follow us on social media at watchclicker or at 40and20_watchclicker. If you want to support the show, and oh boy, we hope you do that at patreon.com/40and20. We really need the money, you guys. We really need the money. No, we don't. We're fine. But it costs a lot to keep this thing going.
More is better.
Don't forget to tune back in next Tuesday for another hour of watches, food, drinks, life, and other things we like.
Bye-bye.